Hey, mateys, and welcome to this week's Drop of the Ocean podcast. I'm your host, Josh Tebbett. And today on the show, we are privileged enough to have Greg Pickering with us. Greg Pickering is a professional abalone diver, currently in Port Lincoln, South Australia. He's also Australian spearfishing champion. Today, we're going to be discussing how Greg developed such an amazing love for the ocean. What have been some of his challenges and also some of the great experiences he's had in the water. So without further ado, Greg, welcome to the show.
Yeah, pleased to be with you.
Fantastic. So you've just sort of got out of the water today. You've had your first day diving in South Australia. It's been a few weeks out of the water, but how was your day?
Yeah, day went very well, actually. It was a beautiful day. Nice and clear, not much wind, a little bit of swell, but really enjoyable conditions. First day that I've been in the water for about 4 weeks, so just sort of take it a bit steady and not push it too hard.
Fantastic. And did you see anything exciting today?
Oh, lots of fish, lots of leather jackets and blue grouper trying to eat the abalone that I was catching.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they never stop trying.
Yeah, they can be quite friendly at times, that's for sure. So, mate, let's just sort of bring it all back and start from the beginning. Can you tell us a bit about sort of where you grew up, how you grew up, and who sort of brought you to the ocean and who influenced you into experiencing the ocean to start?
I think it was just a bunch of friends that lived very close by to me. We all talked about going diving with hand spears on the local coast off Adelaide, which is where I lived. And we went out with hand spears after small fish. And that was when you were allowed to dive in the metropolitan area, not allowed to anymore. But you go to the beach, you'd see other people doing the same thing. And I think that's what really got me into it, is seeing other guys clambering along the rocks there at Merino Rocks and Hallett's Cove, and going down to the jetty and looking down into the clear water and just thinking that it'd be a nice experience to go in the water to see what it was like, see what was under there.
So fantastic.
That's what started it.
Yeah, right. So from there, I guess spearfishing is one of those sports where you constantly evolve, and at least the first few years, I find that you can quite rapidly progress. How did you find going from, say, a young tackle with a pole spear or a Hawaiian sling, moving on to spear guns and bigger fish?
Yeah, well, I started off with a hand spear. It was an aluminium one that my father made. It was not that effective. I got a few fish, but I wasn't until I was about 15 when I got a spear gun. So I've been doing it for about 4 or 5 years, I think, relatively unsuccessfully. Then I got a spear gun when I was 15, and for my birthday, it was an undersea Mark I zip gun, I think it was.
Wow.
And I started shooting a few fish. It's still a pretty small spear gun, but usually most of the fish, the spear used to bounce off them. We didn't have a lot of really big fish around Adelaide. It was just mainly dusky moor. Some of those were probably would have been over 10 kilo, and yeah, like the spear wouldn't even touch them, really.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess from shooting dusky morwongs and leather jackets in South Australia, you've been to some cool places and shot some bigger fish. Do you want to share some of the more exotic places and the sort of larger fish that you've shot?
Yes. Mainly, whenever I went away from Adelaide, it was always better. First to York Peninsula, then to Eyre Peninsula. There were bigger fish. I suppose the first big fish I ever got was a blue grouper, probably about 20 kilo. Seemed pretty big to me at the time. Authorpe Island, off York Peninsula. I read a magazine article in Skin Diving in Australia. And it was called Almighty Allthorpes. And that really spurred us all on to going over there to try and get the blue grouper. Then it was kingfish. They were not particularly often speared in South Australia at the time. It was like a, you know, like a trophy fish that very few people attained in South Australia, but there was plenty of them once you found them, but we didn't know where they were. Yeah, getting a kingfish was a big step, and then going on to other states, going to West Australia, getting Spanish mackerel, and going to New South Wales and spearing large mulloway. They were great days and great steps. And just the better places I went to were mainly northern New South Wales, Queensland. The Queensland area was very good, and West Australia, particularly up north.
Yeah, I mean, yep. And you hold the current state record in WA for Spanish mackerel out of Carnarvon, 44 kilos, which is a very big mackerel.
Yeah, it's 46 kilos. Yeah.
46, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I wouldn't want to rub 3 kilos.
So, that was like a 20-year fish. I went there a long time ago. I think I went there about 1980, the first time I went there, from South Australia. And seeing Spanish mackerel and seeing bigger ones and just kept me going. That just seemed to be my favourite fish. Mm. And everything I did was based around spearfishing for Spanish mackerel.
Yeah, it's a pretty sought after fish, especially on the West Australian coast. What's sort of going through your head when you see a big mackie come in? I mean, it's an exciting sort of feeling seeing one come in, but how do you stay cool, calm, and collected? And what are you thinking about when you're hunting?
Try not to get too excited. They sometimes can be very, very wary. They spook.
Mm-hmm.
Just depends on the moon, I think, but they act differently. Sometimes you just can't seem to even make one movement, and it seems to scare them. Other yep. times they just seem to be passing by, and they're sort of going to a set point, so they don't seem to bother. You can sort of approach them a lot easier, but it's just strange. It's just on how they react, how they behave during, you know, it's just,
yeah, for sure. I mean, sometimes they'll just swim right up to you and be as dumb as a dog, and other times they're super flighty and you can't get close, which can be frustrating. So that's spearfishing. We might come back to it. But you are a professional abalone diver. How long have you been doing that, and how did you get into it?
I think about 1980, I walked into Adelaide Skin Diving Centre in Adelaide. It was run by Paul Lunn, and it was really the main scuba diving, spearfishing shop in South Australia at the time. And I had won this South Australian Spearfishing Championship probably, I think, 3 or 4 times by that stage. And the guy asked me, so how would you like to get a job abalone diving? I said, yeah, I'd give it a go. And I was only 22, I think, stage. And I ended up going over to the Eyre Peninsula and working for a diver, and eventually buying an abalone license. And then I've just been in the abalone industry 40 years now. So I don't own a license anymore, but I still do the same work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my 40th season this year, so I'm probably one of the last originals left.
Yeah, you're a true veteran, that's for sure. What draws you to it to keep coming back year after year?
Well, the idea of going into abalone diving for me was I thought I could earn enough money so I could go diving and spearfishing all around Australia. That was my original reason for doing it. And I did exactly that, and it gave me the opportunity to travel all around Australia and all around the world, and I'm really, really thankful to that. It's hard work, but you get time off, you get time to pace yourself, you can have rest when you're tired, when the weather's bad, but you've got to be fired up when the weather's good, you've got to go. I love diving. I just appreciate it. I appreciate what's here on Eyre Peninsula a lot more now than I did when I was younger. When I went all around Australia, and I've seen all the fishing around Australia, but I've come to realise that what's here in South Australia is pretty special, and it keeps me wanting to go out. And yeah, I mean, there's always something new, even after 40 years, there's something different you come across you've never seen before. I like to take the camera in the water and record things to try to get a record of unusual species. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing new fish even now, new species that I've never seen before. And I want to get a record of everything I can.
That's fantastic. And you record every dive that you've ever done, is that right?
Not every dive, but quite a lot.
Okay. Yeah. So not every dive, but quite a lot of diving. So, you spend that much time underwater, you're going to see a fair few species, and also some of the bigger species, I guess. Just want to move on to sort of the shark encounters that you've had. So from the start, do you remember your first encounter with a shark underwater?
Yes, my first encounter with a shark underwater would have been at Brighton Jetty off Adelaide. We were just swimming off the end of the jetty there, and two of us, and Bronze Whaler came right up to my friend, about 8 to 10 foot. But yeah, that was like back about 1971 or something.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, but yeah.
Yep.
Used to see a few sharks along that metropolitan coast. Every now and then you'd see the odd Bronze Whaler, but first white pointer I saw was 1981 off Port right. Lincoln.
So 10 years between the Bronze Whaler and the white pointer. And was the white pointer when you were spearfishing or when you were ab diving?
Actually, it was spearfishing that day.
Mm-hmm.
Just down in the local islands off Port Lincoln. Nice and clear, beautiful diving, plenty of fish. First dive of the day under the boat. And I saw something moving across the sand on the edge of visibility about 20 metres. And it's very good visibility for South Australia. And I thought, it's a dolphin. And then it was just cruising along the sand. I said, no, it's not. It's a shark. And then I knew straight away it's a white pointer. It came right up to me. It suddenly just flicked. And then all of a sudden it was right one meter off my gun. And it surprised me how quick it could move.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're such a big animal. I've never seen one underwater, but it seems like they really can just turn on a dime. And for such a large animal, the maneuverability of them seems quite impressive.
Yes. It came right up to the end of my gun, and I just seemed to forget that I was underwater, and I went to yell out to my mate, who was just putting his wetsuit on, my mate Dean Acklin. He was just putting his wetsuit on, and I got a mouthful of water and something. I scrambled to the surface and I pulled myself over the side of the boat, quite high sides actually. But I don't know how I did it. I just pulled myself over like I didn't weigh anything. It was incredible. Just strength and adrenaline.
And do you think the shark was pretty curious, or it was sort of in attack mode, or what do you think was going through the shark's mind?
No, I think it was pretty curious.
Yeah.
Pretty close to a seal colony. The water was clear. I think that helps for the help. The fact that I saw the shark, probably saw it. I don't know. He probably saw me, but I saw it pretty close. I saw it pretty straight away, and then it came right up to me. And I think because I had a gun and I was looking at it, it sort of made it stop. Didn't come any closer. And it.
Interesting. So it almost could detect that you were aware of its presence. And
I believe so.
So, I mean, you spent 40 years on the South Australian Southern Australian coast. You would have seen your fair share of great whites. Yeah, could you give us a rough number of how many sharks do you think you've seen?
Yeah, my count was about 20. There's at least three or four that was seen by the guy in the boat, that I didn't see it. I was in the water and it came alongside the boat. So,
right.
But yeah, 20 that I can remember.
Okay. Yep. So that's, roughly once every really. 2 years. Okay.
Yeah, but it's not that many sharks considering the number of days. You know, some of the times it's 100 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, so small odds, but.
Yeah. Yep. I would have, I guess I would have guessed more, but that's really interesting to know. So you have had a couple of pretty gnarly shark encounters. The first one was with a bronze whaler off the West Australian coast, bit you on the lower leg, and you ended up in hospital with that one. What was happening in the water, and what was happening? Were there fish in the water? Was there excitement? And can you run us through that one?
My friend Barry Paxford had speared something, and I was in the boat, and he yelled out for help, and I thought he had shot a fish, and he thought I think he wanted me to jump in the water and double shoot it. So he jumped in and dived down, and it just attacked me. I should have asked him what's going on, but I thought he had a mackerel on him. He was going to lose it. And I dived down and it just charged me. It really mm-hmm. quick. Didn't have time to take evasive action. It just charged me and went 1-2 on the leg. Then it just turned away. Once it bit into the leg, it just stopped and bailed out. And I dropped my gun. Everyone saw it. Two of the guys mm-hmm. in the woods. But that wasn't too bad. I mean, I came to the surface and got in the boat, wrapped a towel around my leg, and we were talking about it calmly on the way back. It wasn't like a panic, or there wasn't too much blood.
Sure, it was just a love bite, per se.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. it was like we were talking about what had happened, and we had about 7 Ks to go back to the beach.
Right.
And then when I got there, somebody was there waiting for us to take me to the hospital. But it wasn't a traumatic experience. It was like I had to accept. I sort of got a bit upset at the start with, oh, my leg's buggered now, and then I just wrapped the towel around. After that, I just calmed down.
What was it like? What was the fight actually like? How did it feel? I know it's a strange question, but I've sort of looked into shark attacks. A lot of people say it's almost like a sucking motion when a shark does bite.
I just felt the teeth bite into the bone. Like a jarring sort of feeling, and it was the sound.
Okay.
It's a sort of teeth on bone sound. I don't know if I could
like explain. Crunchy.
Yeah, a crunch.
Almost like a dog gnawing on a bone, maybe.
Yeah, and it was quite audible. I could hear it. And that was it, really. We lost the gun. We went back. Barry went back there a couple of days later and he found the gun.
Oh, that's good.
We knew exactly. Well, that's one of the spots we go to, the gutter there, so he's very familiar with the area. I was not bad at losing son's gun.
Oh, Lee, or what's his other son's
Scott.
Name?
Scott. Oh. Gun, I think it was.
I'm sure he would have been upset, but maybe understanding after all he did get bitten.
Yeah, so we got that back. He got that back a couple of days later.
Yeah, oh, that's good. Okay, so your second attack was, I guess, not so forgiving, but you did survive, which is, just the story is incredible. I just want to ask you, what was your sort of initial reaction when it happened? Were you pretty conscious and aware of what was going on? Can you take us through that one?
All right. All I remember is swimming along the bottom in about 15 metres of water. I was free swimming. And I came to the edge of a reef where it dropped down to about 20, 22 metres. And I had a look down. I couldn't see the abalone. So I just turned back and swam back the same direction I came from. I must have swum about 2 or 3 metres. And I felt something impacted to my head. Something crashed into my head with quite a bit of force, and I thought, the boat's hit me. Have you ever been in the water and a boat's come up to you and banged you in the head? Just like that.
Mm-hmm.
It hurt, and I felt boats hit me, I could feel my shoulder being lacerated. I thought the propeller is chopping my shoulder up. And then so this is in about a couple of seconds. And then I thought, no, I'm down 15 meters. Then I heard the sound of teeth on bone, very similar to the sound I just described about the first attack. It's the same sort of sound. It's all this thrashing noise and teeth on bone. And then I suddenly, I don't know how long, it seemed like only about 10 seconds or 15 seconds after, I realized it must be a shark. And then I'm trying to work out what to do. So then my face mask was pulled away and also my regulator out of my mouth. And then suddenly it stopped. For some reason, I don't really know why. It has been suggested by some of my friends that the shark might have bit the regulator and purged air out of it, and it scared it.
Mm-hmm.
Did stuff a bit right across the face. A fair chance that's what happened. The shark did bite the regulator as well.
Yep.
And it startled it. And then it stopped. Then the biggest problem was I've got no air and couldn't see, well, not very well. And I just swam straight to the surface. I could see light. And I was getting short of air as well. So I got to the surface there, gasping for air, but I was okay. And then the guy in the boat, Callum, he was in the boat 40 metres away.
Yep.
And he saw me come up quite quickly like that. And suddenly, and he came over straight away. He thought it was something wrong, I think. And I had a cutaway in the side of my boat, like a door, which you can pull out, make it easier for the diver to get in the boat.
Yes.
I was able to pull myself into the boat very quickly because I was really worried that the shark was going to come up and grab my legs from underneath. And my shoulder was very sore, but I just managed to summon the strength to pull myself into the boat really quickly. And I remember laying on the deck just feeling relieved.
Yeah. That you were out of the water, or you were just...
Yeah, that I was out of the water. Yeah.
Okay.
And then he saw straight away what had happened. And I just remember I was able to give instructions what to do. I said, get the satellite phone, call 111 or 000. And he made some calls to some people and had a bit of trouble trying to explain to them what had happened.
Sure, but yeah.
People just didn't really understand what was going on. Saying, oh, you know, what houses at what addresses?
Yeah, I mean, you were in a very remote part of the coastline. Yeah. So yeah. How long did it actually take you to get to hospital in the end?
It was about 10 hours.
Wow.
So luckily there was another boat within 1 kilometer. That was actually Shannon was in the other boat with his name, Andrew Rowe.
Okay, so Shannon from Shark Eyes.
Yeah, Shannon was in the water diving, that's right.
Wow.
We were able to get them to help us get the boat back on the trailer, because that was the best place for me to stay, was in the boat, to lay on the deck of the boat.
Yeah. Were you just pumping full of adrenaline at this stage, or were you pretty out of it?
I could feel myself getting a little bit faint after a few minutes after I got in the boat, but I had a bottle of oxygen right next to me, and I was able to switch that on and start breathing oxygen. That helped a lot. It just helped me. I don't know. I was feeling a bit weak, and it just seemed to settle me.
Sure.
And I was laying there thinking, oh, I might die, but I wasn't panicking. I managed to stay very calm. I don't know why, but I get upset about little things in life, but things like that, I just seem to be able to relax and just shut down and not panic. But I was just laying there saying, oh, I might just go to sleep and never wake up. And right. I just accepted it. If it happens, it happens.
You're almost at peace.
I've had a good life, you know, and if that's what happens, that's what happens. So, but yeah, I just kept hanging in there. I was just lying on the deck looking up at the sky. I was saying to myself, well, I'm still going. I'm still okay. And we got the boat on the trailer, and then we would have had a lot of trouble without the other guys helping us. And I stayed in the boat, and they drove down to drove along the track for about 40 or 50 miles or 40 or 50 kilometres. But we'd called up ambulance people. There were people coming. Mm-hmm. It's a long, long way. It was 160 kilometres from Esperance.
Wow.
And they sent a guy who was working on a farm who was the closest medical person. He was only about 70 or 80 k's away, so he was the closest. And he met us along the track. And he knew all the medical practices. He took my pulse and everything, and he rode with me 30 or 40 kilometres until we met the ambulance. But by that stage, I started to think that I was going to make it, because he said, oh, what's your pain level? I said, oh, about 8. And everybody, they were glad, because I sort of was tolerating it. It's like the pain was intense, but I could tolerate it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel I was getting any worse. I was breathing okay. I wasn't panicking. And he took my pulse and he rode with me. And I just felt like once he came in the boat with me, we were just going along the track slowly, and it was quite a nice ride. And I felt like I reckon I'm going to make it. Then we got to the ambulance, which was sort of picked us up near where the bitumen ends on the road from Esperance. And there was a fully fledged doctor in the back, and they had blood and everything in there. And that was a pretty comfortable ride to Esperance.
Did you end up losing a lot of blood?
I think I lost quite a bit.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what they did, but they had all blood there. They must have given me blood. I can't remember, but I never went to sleep. The whole time from when it happened to when I got to hospital, I stayed awake.
That's unreal.
I just started to feel more and more comfortable that I was going to make it. And, yeah, got to the hospital there, and there was a nice nurse came out to greet me, and I said something like, oh, you're a pretty looking girl. It's just, you know, it just sort of helps, you know. And I started to feel pretty good about it, because I was on the plane, and we got to Jandakot Airport, and then I went up to the hospital, and my family was waiting there, and my daughter, Janessa, my second daughter, she said to me, oh, what's that in your eye, Dad? They put a bit of plastic in there to keep your eye open. And I said, oh, I don't know. I don't think they have. And she looked in there, oh, it's a tooth.
Wow.
And it was in the top of my eye. But it didn't damage. No way. It was 19 millimetres long, and it went through sort of the skin above the eye and then went into the top of the eye, or into the globe, they call it. And it, I don't know how deep it went, but they had to take it out. But that's I could incredible. Still see. Anyway, I was in pretty bad shape, I think. The face was all ripped open and that, but my family put on a pretty brave face. But I went into the Royal Perth and the trauma unit and that, and the best people in West Australia, I'd say, the best surgeons. There was one guy that stitched me up and one guy that got the tooth out of my eye, and that was about 10 hours worth of surgery, but they did a fantastic job. It wasn't that long. It was only a couple of days and I was walking around.
That's unreal. And where's the tooth now? Have you got it in a safe place?
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah, wow. It was the tooth from the very rear of the jaw.
Okay, and so you were all the way back.
Yeah, so the rear of the jaw was where my eye was. The front of the jaw was where my shoulder was. So I think it hit me in the head and then obviously tried to get get me into its mouth further. And so I'd say my head was right inside. I have the front of my face from my right eye sort of down to my lip was all cut. I had a cut on my neck and cuts right across my back. So I was definitely right inside it.
And, yep. You were a
miracle.
You're as deep as, you'd like to get inside of a shark's mouth, that's for sure.
No, but it really was a miracle. It was one of those things that I just really couldn't explain how I got out of it. I think it was just pure luck that it stopped. If it kept going, I can't see why it couldn't have just obliterated me, but it just stopped, you know. But it did a lot of damage just in that short time, but I don't think it was longer than 15 seconds.
Sure.
But I don't know for sure. It's very hard to sort of relate to the time, but it didn't seem that long, but enough time for me to realize what was happening.
And then after the incident, how did your relationship with the ocean change?
Yes. Well, it really helped me when I say generally, it made me look at things that are important to me in my life carefully, and the things that weren't important, I didn't think about them anymore. And just the things that are important to me, it made me refocus on those things. So I said, yes, I want to go back diving. It took about 2 months. Of course, you're fearful. I still have that feeling sometimes when I'm diving by myself or just going for a swim that something could just crash into me again.
Mm-hmm. I get that feeling. It's always in the back of your mind.
Yeah. That not all the time, but just sometimes.
Yeah.
When you get that, when you perhaps you're diving with some other guys and you just drift a little bit further away and you're just on your own. Occasionally I do feel a bit sort of vulnerable. But
yeah. It's a pretty amazing feat to be able to have that experience and then, you know, muster up the courage only 2 months later to get back in the water. So that's pretty inspiring, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of help from a friend of mine, Chris Wood. He said he was going to go to Madagascar for a dive trip. And I said, oh, I was recovering. And he said, oh, would I like to go? I said, oh, yeah, I'll go. I don't know if we go and dive and I'll dangle my feet in the water and throw a rod and line in the water. But he helped me sort of train up again. I started going diving and I started going to the pool every day and swimming. And after a couple of months, I got pretty fit and got pretty much full strength again. And I went to Madagascar and I was diving really well. And I didn't have, it was a great trip. It really helped me. It was a goal. I've got to hit this trip. And it really helped me with my recovery.
That's fantastic. Really good. Next thing I want to talk about briefly is Shark Eyes and your involvement there. So can you just give us a brief explanation of what Shark Eyes is and how it works?
Well, Shark Eyes is a concept that I think Shannon came up with. I think it's mimicry, really. Some animals in the wild use patterns on their skin or on their bodies to mimic. Their eyes, and I think it has been known to work with animals quite effectively. And I think that's the idea of using is to try to convince any potential shark that there may be a pair of eyes looking at you, and you better be careful. It's something that can't hurt.
Yeah.
I think there's not enough information really available to say whether it's 100% effective or not, but I think it's a great idea. I think it's great for surfing. I think he's quite good at surfing, and I think he's sort of probably bigger in the surfing side of it.
Sure. Another set of eyes can't hurt, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. So I think it's a great idea. Gave me a pair of fins and I've been using them. They're beautiful carbon fins with the shark eyes on them, and I honestly haven't seen any sharks in about 4 years, which I just don't understand. But haven't seen any for a while, so I don't know what.
I mean, that's a sort of good thing in your line of work, anyway.
Yes.
What's
4 years ago? So yeah.
Right. What's your take on the shark population on the southern Australian coast? Do you think it's increased over the 40 years that you've been in the water? Or do you think it's decreased? Have you noticed any change of behaviour?
Certainly around Esperance, I think there's probably more white sharks around Esperance than anywhere. Port Lincoln has had quite a lot of sharks, but seems to be times when there isn't any around. I don't understand it. I mean, I've seen a few here, but I've been here a long time, and I've worked around Esperance only for about 3 years, and I saw quite a few. So
yeah,
I think Esperance probably got more for some reason. I think that's one of the worst places in Australia for them.
Interesting. Just want to touch on what you have found really challenging in your line of work or being in the ocean, and how you've sort of developed ways to overcome those challenges.
Yeah, well, the biggest thing with avalanche diving is you get tired. You get into your body knows it's over. I used to do a lot of swimming. I don't anymore. I use a machine, but for 30-odd years, I swam all the time. And when you're young, you can go quite a bit longer, I think. But you always run into a wall. You just feel like your body just noses over, and you have to be able to push through it. And that's really what avalanche diving is about, is putting up with those sorts of things. It gets cold, it gets rough, you get thrown around. All these things are trying to make you stop. You've just got to sort of push through them to be successful.
Yep.
It's about adapting to it as best you can, but there's always going to be those uncomfortable moments when you've got to fight against it and just stay in the water. It's the only way you can make a living is to stay in the water.
Sure. Yep. I mean, the more time you spend down there, the more abalone you can collect, and that brings home the bacon at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, there's always going to be days when you don't really want to go. Conditions aren't suitable. Lots of things to put you off. You can make an excuse for every day if you wanted to. You can say, well, I want to go because of this or that. But generally, you've just got to be prepared to go out and do it when it's not the best. But you can't expect it to be nice like today. Today was very nice. It doesn't get much better than that. It's normally quite a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
Today was pretty ideal.
Yeah, fantastic. Look, Greg, if people wanted to ask you any questions, you know, will they have anything they wanted to discuss you about? Is there a way they can contact you if you wanted to be contacted?
Yeah, well, I can be contacted by email or message me on Facebook, I'd say. A lot of people message me on Facebook these days, so that's quite a good way to do it.
Yep.
And I'm usually, lots of people contact me that I don't really know, or I've only just heard the name, and they ask questions about all sorts of things. I'm happy to tell anyone whatever I know. I'm happy to share my knowledge with anybody.
That's fantastic. Awesome. Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on board, and I guess, you know, just hearing stories when I started spearfishing about you and just your repertoire, and then, you know, hearing about your shark attacks and what you've gone through, and just talking to you today and hearing about your just positive sense, and even the sort of ride back to the hospital and how you were just in great spirits is just amazing to hear. And I've just loved having you on board. I wish you all the best for your abalone diving future and ocean adventures. I can't wait to see what you get up to.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Fantastic. All right, guys, we hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of the Ocean Podcast. If you have any questions, drop us a line. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Don't forget, guys, if you go down to the beach, pick up plastic, pick up your rubbish, The ocean needs to be clean of rubbish, so keep it out of the sea. Take three for the sea. So share the ocean love, go get salty, and tune in next time for next week's episode. Thanks. Bye.